Du lytter til Fitness MK. Det er programmet for os, der træner. I dag der skal vi snakke om og med Martin Rooney. Og det er et interview over Skype, fordi at han bor i USA. Her i Fitness MK snakker vi om vores trænings- og sportsliv. Og det dækker også forskellige træningskoncepter. Og grunden til, at vi snakker med Martin Rooney, det er fordi, at han har opfundet det træningskoncept, der hedder Training for Warriors, og dem, der har fulgt med i træningsmiljøet i lidt længere tid, vil kunne huske ham som en del af det, der hedder Parisi's Beach School, som var et atletiktrænings koncept eller projekt, han har rejst rundt med en stor del af sin ungdom, for at hjælpe folk med at blive hurtigere sammen med Bill Parisi. Vi har snakket med ham tidligere i Fitness MK nummer... Puha, helt tilbage i 60'erne engang. 61, tror jeg, det var. Skal vi lige finde den igen her? Den var nummer 61, ja. Så det er altså temmelig mange afsnit siden. Jeg er svært, Anders Nedergaard, a.k.a. Dr. Muskel. Man er selvfølgelig velkommen til at skrive ind til programmet, og det kan man på afn@AndersNedergaard, eller på programmets Facebook-side. Interviewet, det kommer. Hi there.
Hey.
Thank you for taking your time to talk with us again. I just checked up on the episode numbers, and it's about 184 episodes since we last talked, and that's 3.5 years.
It's hard to believe. I mean, I always enjoy coming to Denmark, and man, the toughest thing is I had it all planned to return, and now I don't know how things are going to work with our current situation, but I am coming back, and then we'll hopefully get to do another one of these in person.
So for the ones that didn't catch up or didn't hear the first episode we did, we may have had some new listeners since then. Can you please let them know who Martin Rooney is and what he's known for?
Oh, sure. Well, I'll try to keep this brief so everyone hears. And before I do, I hope everybody, if you're listening to this in the DK, I hope everyone is safe right now and doing the right things, where I have so many friends in all the way from Copenhagen to Svendborg. And I know right now times are tough, and I'm hoping this message today will also motivate some people. But my story, I grew up outside of New York City as a kid. I played lots of different sports, and my mom was a physical education teacher, and she inspired me, and sports was always something big in my life. I played every sport growing up, but track and field or athletics was the one where I really performed the best. And I went to university for track and field, specifically the sprints and the javelin throw. And then I went on to the Medical University of South Carolina and got my degree in physio or physical therapy, and also my master's degree in health. So I have 3 degrees in, you know, exercise and health. And during that time, in a weird thing that happened, I actually made the U.S. bobsleigh team. So, you know, if you've seen the bobsled at the Olympics, I was on the U.S. team and traveled around the world and lived at the Olympic Training Center and got to see training at the highest levels in sport. And I knew then sport was what I wanted to do with my life. But the world said, no, you should be a physio. That's a real job. That's a good job, you know. And so I became a physio when my career was over. And immediately, hey, I loved helping people. I loved the human body. But I knew something was missing. And so maybe the first message everyone should hear is, at this time, when you're getting to spend a lot of time with yourself and to reflect, man, make sure you're not spending your career on something you don't love. You know, like maybe this is a great opportunity to discover again, what is it that you really love to do? And could you figure out a way to do it? And that's what I did. And my friend and I, Bill Parisi, we kind of started the sports performance industry for youth in the United States with a company called the Parisi Speed School. Now, 20-something years later, we've trained over 1 million kids. It's all over the U.S. And now so many people understand to train their children and train their athletes. But back then, no one knew it. They thought lifting weights would stunt growth. Girls should never lift or, you know, even train for sport. but we pushed this forward. And during that period, I was working with a lot of professional sport teams. I was working with, in particular, I was working with the New York Giants, the New York Jets. I had hundreds of guys going to the NFL, and I was training a lot of the top. I was the original guy to train UFC fighters, you know, and I know Martin Kampman there, who's a friend of mine, and now Mark, your Olympic medalist in wrestling, who is now also in MMA. But I was the original guy before all those guys training, physical training for those fighters before it was even a sport that was not banned. You know, it was a banned sport. People thought it was a bad thing, but I loved it. And I was helping these fighters. And that led to books, that led to seminars. And those seminars led to something called Training for Warriors, which is now a fitness company that we have all over the world. One of our greatest locations is in Svendborg. Dennis Rasmussen runs that one, and he's doing amazing things with our program there in Denmark. And now, currently, I'm trying to spread the word about coaching, fitness, and health. I just released a new book called Coach to Coach, which is a story, but it's a story that teaches all the lessons of how people can become great coaches, which I think is the most important thing people could hear right now. And that's where we currently are. And now I'm sitting here doing a podcast in the DK.
Yeah. So where do you live now?
So now I live outside of Charlotte in North Carolina. And yeah, maybe I should say too, I have four daughters. So I know if anyone is listening, if you're going to say, hey, four daughters, are you going to try for the boy? You know, I've already tried four times. So I think we're done, but I have four daughters. They're all in sport. And in particular, my oldest is a very high level track and field athlete now here for her age in the U.S. But unfortunately, like anyone listening now, this was going to be a big year for her, and that year is over, but we're still training and we're still getting our workouts and trying to stay focused, which I hope everyone else is doing too. But, and again, I say that I have children that are doing well, not to impress everybody, but to impress upon you that the hardest person to coach is your kids. And I've been trying to make sure that I can do that right too.
Yeah. I feel, man, may the Lord have pity on your soul for having four daughters. How old are they?
Right now I am outnumbered in my house. So with my wife and my four daughters, it's 5-1. And even the two cats, we have two cats, they're female too. So it's really like 7-1 right now.
Yeah.
But my youngest is 7. My third daughter is 11. My next daughter is 13. And then my oldest is 17. So, you know, we have them pretty spread out. And now we're getting to spend more time than ever right now. And it's interesting that we have to all look at the blessings of, hey, now families are going to get closer, even though we're distancing ourselves from others. Certainly. And this is a real, you know, this is a real time to, again, to develop some good habits. And, you know, so many people, Anders, always tell me that, oh, I'm so busy, I can't train, or I'm so busy, I can't eat right, or I'm so busy, I can't read or do the things I want to do, where hopefully today this is a reminder that everybody's not so busy anymore, you know, like, or they're spending too much time being busy worrying, and that's not helping anyone. So I'm hoping that this is a coaching challenge today that everybody should get busy doing some of those things that they always said they didn't have time for.
Do you know the Danish term hygge?
Oh, of course.
Actually, I'm hygging myself much more than appropriate with all of this. I get to spend a lot more time with my kids and take long walks. And the weather is pretty nice. It's cold, but it's the sun is up and it's very dry. And I get to play board games and read books. And
There's going to be in the States. It's kind of funny for everyone listening. There's been many books lately, all written about hygge. I don't think anybody knows how to say it right here. They probably say higgy, you know, instead of hygge.
Yeah.
But because I've spent so much time there, like not only do I love the concept, but one of the concepts that I got from the DK that we made a big part of our company is Overskud. And I think right now the hygge and the Overskud is more important than ever, that, man, we got to bring everybody together, but we have to do that extra that everyone needs. So, man, I think the Danes are ready for this, you know, and what I like to see too is, even though some people are getting it, it looks like the Danes are very healthy too, where the mortality rate is low, and that's very encouraging too.
Well, actually, the Danes have a slightly lower average life expectancies than the other Scandinavian countries because we smoke a lot more.
You know, and I know you drink, I think you guys are the number one in coffee too.
And I think we may be leaders in alcohol as well, but now let's not go too far into that.
Yeah, there's some things we got to stop leading in Denmark, yeah. And that is definitely one of them. We can't be number one in handball and drinking. That's not the two best things, you know. Handball, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone needs to have vices, and I think the average Dane, they smoke less weed when they're young, but then they drink more. I don't know which one is preferable, but
kids are going. Hey, right now, I think that's important for everybody listening. You know how you just said, yeah, everybody has some vices. Well, I'm challenging everybody. Hey, let's make that vice spending time with the kids, maybe reading a book. But also, what are we talking about there? It's routine or habit. And right now, I think that's the biggest. And for everyone listening, we've just been put on mandatory lockdown for 21 days. It just started today, but I've been in the house for almost 2 weeks now. Now with another 21 days, that'll be a month. And I think people, even myself, I had to get used to a routine. How am I going to train in my home? How am I going to get outside? What am I reading? How am I making sure I'm not on the phone 24/7 right now and just reading the wrong things that are making me nervous? And I think everybody right now needs to do this, not just for physical health, but for mental health too. And you know, I know that's traditionally not as much of what I talk about, but I think it's going to be more important forever. Not just when we say Denmark or the US, but it's everywhere in the world. We're all from one country right now, and that country is Earth, and we got to all do our part.
Yeah. Do you live in the countryside and the city?
No, I would say it's a town. You know, we're not in the city, but we're 20 minutes outside, which, you know, we have houses all near us, and you know, so I can't call it the countryside, but I'm not in the city either. So they call it like the suburbs, in the US. And so I would say we're in that, but already we've heard of not only people in our community that have the coronavirus, but right now I have some friends, you know, because where I'm originally from, right outside New York City, is now the real hot zone in the US and very dangerous. And my one friend, his father is in on a ventilator right now in very critical condition. So I'm really concerned where, hey, this is real. You know, this is no joke.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm guessing that the public debate about the interventions to counter the coronavirus, it seems like it's pretty much the same in the States as it is in Denmark, where you have these people that you have all the conspiracy nuts that claim that it's not a real thing at all, and it's some kind of a conspiracy or 5G or whatever. And then you have the economically, that would be liberal in the Danish terms, the economic right-wingers that claim that the restrictions on behavior is too expensive for the economy. And then you have all the centrist, social liberal that just accept all of the restrictions very, very, very fully and wholeheartedly, and it's so obvious who is going to take which points of, and it's just, we just have to, I mean, what you or I think about how things are rolling out isn't going to influence the outcome in any way whatsoever, so we might as well lay back and.
Well, you've described it well, where I think it's like a bell-shaped curve. You're going to have people all over in different ways of thinking. And unfortunately, I think everybody needs to be more unified than ever. That'll never happen in terms of the ways that people think. But yeah, we're seeing the same stuff. And why? Because now with social media and the internet, I think everyone is reading the same things. So we're all becoming unified more than ever. But yeah, I think the people thinking it's not real or whatever is crazy. And really, hey, we have to be honest. We're trying to protect our elderly and our immunocompromised. And yes, the economy is gonna really suffer in certain capacity. But I think this is setting us up for future issues like this. I think medicine is going to be better than ever. I think the collaboration around the world is better than ever. And what I'm really hoping for is that, our greatest scientists in the world really pull something off so that this doesn't be something that happens, this can't happen regularly, but also we cannot put all our elderly at risk either. Imagine being a world leader right now. You can't say, we're just going to let everybody get it to keep businesses open and take a chance, because no one wants to be responsible for that. And everybody has to play their part. The economy is going to come back. We've had world wars. We've had economic crashes before. We're going to survive this, but everybody needs to do their part. And that's the piece I'm more scared about, is not the people that think it's not real. It's the people that are ignoring the requests to not spread it. That if we did this better, I think we would have a better opportunity to either slow it or definitely save a lot of people. And that's why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Yeah. When it became obvious how infectious the coronavirus is, I was really thinking about all the American people without health insurance. That's going to be a massive clusterfuck.
Yeah. Well, I think it's more, they're not worried as much about the insurance as they are about the availability. What happened in Italy, if you saw, was the hospitals, which they have a great medical system, but they were not prepared for the influx of people. And, the stories that I was hearing, because I have so many friends there too, that doctors were having making decisions of who lives and who won't. Yeah. It's that's something no one should be under. So I think right now the bigger concern is we're trying to slow it so that the hospitals are able to support the people that are going to need help, and that it doesn't become overrun and we have a similar situation. And where I think, hey, they're going to figure out the whole insurance thing. And I think everybody will do the right thing, that if somebody needs incredible help, I don't think they're going to, I don't know what, bankrupt somebody because they had to be on a ventilator at this time. But
that happens all the time, right?
I would say that kind of stuff has happened, but that isn't, I think, the big discussion that's happening right now. I think discussion is the economy. Yeah. And just what, and making sure that the hospitals are going to be prepared with, enough help and protecting our healthcare providers and our service people like policemen and firemen. That's the stuff, is do we have enough masks? Do we have the right gear? Do we have those things are the big points of discussion that I'm seeing, and every day the president and the vice president, everybody, they're coming on and holding press conferences and keeping everybody informed. And that seems to be the bigger issue right now versus, I guess insurance or, things. I think it's more, how's the economy going to do? And is everybody going to do their right thing?
I wasn't thinking about societal perspective, but an individual perspective, because if 10 to 20% of those afflicted will require some kind of intensive care, that's going to suck for those that doesn't have insurance on an individual level.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't even imagine it. But at this point, I guess that's where, I don't think that's what people are thinking. I think we're thinking about keeping people safe. Like right now, to be honest, my mother is old, very old and on oxygen. My father has had heart issues. So, man, they can't get sick. That's what I'm worried about.
Really,
like, I don't care. Yeah, I'm not worried about money or insurance. I'm worried about mortality and how do I prevent them even from going outside at all? How do I get the food to their house? These are the immediate, I guess, concerns. And I think that's affecting everyone, because everyone in this country has an older parent or someone that could be at risk, and those are the people. I would say that at least that's where my mind is at right now versus, creating the worry of, other things.
No. If we can rewind a little bit, and when you were talking about yourself, your own athletic history with track and field and javelin, what Do you have like, do you have the explosive gene in you?
Yeah, I would say definitely. And if, you know, unfortunately, this is a very different interview for me, where if people listen to some of my other stuff where, hey, I have a podcast called Into the Roar and I'm always on fire and pumped up. And, you know, obviously, even under this circumstance, maybe I seem a little bit subdued. But yeah, I would say without a doubt, I'm a fast twitch individual. I have theories because I've trained so many athletes that I believe when your musculature is fast twitch, your nervous system is also, and then your personality is as well, where, you know, when I meet sprinters, they're on fire, they're pumped up people. When you meet, say, a marathon runner, they have a different personality that goes along with that, you know.
And which comes so first?
That, I think, a good question, but I would say they both come together, like as a package deal, you know.
Yeah, so you think it's inherited together or developed physiologically?
Yeah,
or?
I think it's inherited together, where, you know, your musculature. Yeah, it's almost you know how they say nature versus nurture. I would say nature is the part of the musculature I have, and my personality. Nurture is me allowing it to come out and being in an environment to come out. But yeah, so I would say without a doubt, I'm a fast twitch individual, from the numbers that I've always produced in either sprints or explosive events to the fact that I don't like to run anything over 200 meters. So it's, you know, but man, you know, anything under 50 meters, I'm a monster. Anything over 400 meters, I'm a lamb, you know? So yeah. It's, you know, and yeah, my history also, I'm a black belt in judo. I have a lot of records in powerlifting in my age groups in many ways. So I was always very explosive and strong and recognized that from a young age. But I will say that my personality was always on fire and crazy, even when I was still young, I didn't exhibit all those things yet. So I would say they come as a package deal, which is interesting. I don't know if people even talk about that, but I think it's an interesting concept.
You do know Sheldon's body types, right? The whole mesomorph, endomorph, ectomorph.
Absolutely.
He was a psychologist. And he actually started by associating the descriptions of the bodies, associating those with psychological traits. But eventually it was disproven, unfortunately. So it wasn't a good therapy, good theory, but that's the way it goes.
I guess where my theory is going is I'm not talking about the shape. I'm talking about the underlying wiring. So for instance, you know, when we look at the models, when they look at musculature, now remember, for everybody listening, if we want to get technical, muscles are a whole composite of fibers. So you will have slow twitch fibers, you will have fast twitch fibers, and they're not just one or the other. There's a zillion ranges in between of those. But the predominant, say, of an Usain Bolt, as an ultimate example, is he's probably the highest predominance of those faster twitch fibers. And as a result, I believe there is a personality a little bit that maybe comes along with that high strung nervous system. And, you know, that would just be a theory, but having worked with thousands and thousands of athletes, I haven't seen a lot of examples where it's disproven, you know, like, and so very interesting. But remember, somebody could be very, very fast twitch, but he could still be an endomorph. He just never developed himself. So yeah, I don't think the shape overall of a person could match it, but it, you know, there might be some personality traits that go along if somebody matched that with fiber typing, which, hey, that's not the area I'm working in anymore, but could be a cool study.
But I've worked as a scientist for a number of years before I went gray hat, rogue, whatever. I just lost track. What was the point? Damn it. Sorry. It will come back to me at some point.
Yes.
Oh, I'm always the skeptic of that kind of stuff. That was the point. Yeah, I'm always the skeptic. And I know a lot of track and field athletes, and I've coached a few myself, but I'm also aware that there are different cultures between 100-meter runners and 5K runners and marathon runners. Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff going on that could... Yeah.
I think it makes always for interesting discussions, you know, but definitely like my... You know, because I'm a track and field coach now. You know, I've been coaching high school for the last 5 years. And again, I would really say, yeah, like my sprinters, they're a little more high energy, a little more fired up, just as personalities, just like their nervous systems. And those distance people, you know, that, you know, and again, it's a generalization, and yeah, there could be culture with it. It could just be the, how the sport is done, but I bet there could be some really cool stuff people could look into there, you know, which is just cool.
Yeah, but I mean, it could make sense in a lot of ways also that the people's behavior manifest in response to sensations and experiences. And if they're, I'm getting that having a body like that feels a different way than from having a slower body. And I mean, there's a lot of stuff that it can influence.
Oh, one that I like to always say is your emotions follow your motions, you know? So like, hey, what are those motions? Yeah, a person that's going to run 10K or a marathon, yeah, they can't, you know, they can't be their mind exploding every second. They have to stay very focused and lasered for a very long time, which requires a different state, you know? So it's very interesting. But when we look at also how motion and exercise affects the brain, there are chemical cascades that happen, and maybe there are different chemical cascades that happen with different activities, maybe. You know, and, you know, that's sometimes the theories I have. That's why I believe kind of, you know, I have some pretty interesting theories on, you know, there's that old, were humans made to sprint short or were they made to go long? I have some differing theories than sometimes what I hear from some of the prevailing scientists now, but I do believe either way, we were meant to move, and that movement creates chemical cascades in the brain that affect our learning, you know? So, hey, so why not affect our personality too? And hopefully everybody says, wow, this guy just went from a motivator to a philosopher. Boom.
I've worked a lot with weightlifters that also. I mean, successful weightlifters have to be on the high explosive strength, and those personality wise, they're pretty cool headed types mostly, so their phenotype is not, their physiological phenotype is not totally the same as sprinters, because they don't need to have as much reactive strength, but they do need a lot of explosive strength.
Oh yeah, for sure. But also when you watch these guys and they've hit a big lift, look at their reaction. They're screaming, they're exploding, they're, you know, whereas you don't see that in the marathon, you know? So it's, you know, there is a, you know, who knows, but again, interesting concept. And hey, it'd be great for any of the listeners. Hey, let us know what you think on that one, because we weren't even talking about that. And then all of a sudden we're exploring new territory, which is cool.
How old are you now?
So now I'm going to be, I'm 48, and this year I'll be 49, which, you know, that has an effect as well, that I still believe I'm 21 in my mind, I think, but I definitely, and I train every day. So I've been able to maintain, I'll definitely say this, I have maintained my strength at a higher percentage than what usually science would say you would lose after the age of 30. You know, for instance, I've sometimes heard maybe it's, you know, 5 to 10% a decade after 30, where I'm still, you know, I'm definitely not at 80% of my all-time numbers, but I will say that that reactivity and my overall speed, yeah, that I'm not the same guy, you know, like I can't run 10.81 in the 100 meter anymore, you know, or anywhere close. So it's kind of, I have noticed I've maintained my strength, but not the speed or the explosiveness. And what I noticed with a lot of my fighters when I would train them as well, is that is something that they would start to pick up on in their mid-30s and when things got later, that they still had the strength and the stamina, but they couldn't maintain the speed the younger. Yeah. So it was, so that's a very interesting concept too.
Yeah. I mean, I'm 42 now, and I don't train a lot of jump or sprinting because I was always on the opposite end of the spectrum. So it's always a bad experience to test it.
Yeah.
But I mean, I feel when I do a jump test or something, I've lost a couple of percent by now.
Yeah.
But actually, my feeling of when I in the periods where I up my training, I actually feel like my overall training tolerance maybe even increasing a little bit with age.
And there's a mental part that goes with that, and discipline too. But I think
could just be getting less stupid.
Yeah. But I think also the interesting thing is when I looked at it from a physio standpoint, the injuries that happen to young athletes and older athletes, the injuries for younger, it's more pulled muscles, you know, ligament injuries because of explosive movements. Whereas when you look at the athletes our age now, it's tendon injuries and different because now the musculature changes, the chemical composition of the connective tissue becomes more brittle. And so I do believe, if anyone is listening, as the athlete gets much older, and I consider everyone an athlete, yeah, those explosive movements need to be reduced just because of the increased danger to your muscular system, you know? So, you know, and then when you see when someone gets very old, then now it's not the muscles anymore, it's the bones,
yeah,
you know?
Avulsions. And then they,
yeah, so yeah. Avulsions and then broken bones. So that can also be a huge key to understanding how we should train people so that, hey, anybody listening, if you think, oh, I have this boot camp workout, it's so cool, I'm going to make my 70-year-old grandfather do it. Nah, like that person should be doing strength work to maintain musculature and bone density, to maintain longevity, and to do some type of cardiovascular work, but in a much more controlled way so that it isn't dangerous or a shock to the system. And although that may sound elementary, to me, maybe not everybody understands it, you know, so very important.
I always had kind of shitty tendons. So whenever I do something really heavy or strained just a little bit longer than I should, I get something.
Yeah.
You know, one of those things.
Yeah. Sure. And I started the same thing, Anders. I started to experience the same stuff. And then I can't train the same level of explosion. And then you don't have the same speed of performance. But when I continue to train for more now, I guess, hypertrophy, almost bodybuilding, if you will, man, I maintain it and I still do a lot of cardio work. So cardiovascularly, my heart rate is in the 50s when I rest. My blood pressure is great, but I'm definitely not doing the massive explosive things. And I will say this, and I miss it, you know, like, hey, I don't do judo anymore. Why? Because, man, I'm going to get hurt, you know? And man, I miss that. I'm not doing maxed out 100 meters and box jumps, you know, like, why, man, I'm going to get hurt, you know? So, yeah. But you know, and it'll be a study in the aging athlete too.
Yeah. But my point about it is that I call it retard training. When you just go down and do something very high effort, in Denmark we eat a lot of rye bread. You probably know that. I call it rye bread training,
yeah.
like the carrots and you know the good solid. The
And
you have to perform a certain amount of the rye bread training to buy a certain amount of retard training, and with age the amount of rye bread compared to the amount of retard training changes. So you have to do more of the rye bread compared to the retard training.
So for everybody listening, if you're in the U.S., because so you know, that's, we can't say the second one you said. That's a very politically
incorrect. Oh, I know, but I'm extremely politically incorrect. That's that's part of my.
But we would say meat and potatoes.
Yeah, meat and potatoes. Yeah.
Vibrate. We say meat and potatoes. Like, yeah, you gotta do your big lifts and your moves, and then maybe we would say the what word would I use?
Idiot. For
the, crazy. Yeah, like crazy training or. Actually, stupid. You could say stupid, because, hey, people like to do something stupid every once in a while too. But
yeah.
or we would never have more than one beer. Right?
No, no. Like, but I had to think about that since I was 20 because I always had so actually coming into my 40s now, being into my 40s now, I have had the 20 years of experience in coping with that shit. So actually, I'm doing pretty good now.
Yeah, we get smarter, right? There's an interesting line. You'll love this one that, man, I don't know how to say it maybe correctly, but the thing is, when you have youth, you have all the ability. And then when you have age, you have all the knowledge.
Yeah.
But they decrease. So it's like, man, now we know what to do, but we can't physically do it the same. But when we were young, we did everything wrong because we didn't know what to do, you know? So it's, so it's like too young, too fit, and too old, too smart.
Yeah.
But it's, but and there's and that maybe that perfect time is in the early 30s when you have both. And that's why you see many of the athletes, the greatest performances, that it's that late 20s, early 30s when that happens. Yeah. You know,
maturity and accumulated training as well.
Yeah. But you can still do it and not suffer the consequences of the stupid training.
Yeah. All the gyms here closed in Denmark a couple of weeks ago. And I was kind of getting kind of restless and needed something to lift. So a local physiotherapist who had a small gym allowed me and my son to come and train there. Hmm. And my son, he's not been doing any weight training recently because he's been not any like strength training, been doing like more bodybuilding stuff for years. He just started in high school and training with his pals and stuff like that. Yeah. So he went squatting and he did really well. And he did 80 for 5 in beautiful deep Astrogas Olympic squats, and that was actually a personal record for him despite not having trained it for some time. And he really wanted to go for the 90, and then I told him, let it go. Yeah. Let it. It's another PR for another time. It's when you get greedy, it goes wrong. And then he actually he didn't do the 90, and I got so proud.
No, and that's what. And hey, so what are we talking about there? Is coaching, man. Like, see, you did your most important role, and that was to coach instead of living through him and saying, yeah, let's go for 90, let's go for 95, you know, and instead you coached correctly. And really, that's where I'm spending all my time now is actually, because this was stimulating for me today, because I do realize, man, I've spent so much time in the deep science and developing my philosophies on training, but now none of those are valuable unless I can create a connection and coach people that they want to listen. And so now I've spent all my effort trying to make sure that everyone is also a great coach. It doesn't mean knowledge isn't important, but the knowledge won't be useful if no one wants to hear it. And, you know, and that's what the whole new book is about, where it was a departure for me because it wasn't a science book like I usually wrote or an exercise book. This was a story, almost like a movie that people are living through, but they're learning these great lessons. And it's pretty cool. You know, unfortunately, I picked the worst time in history to launch a book, which was last week, but it's helping so many people now. But I want to commend you that you did the right thing because you coached them. You taught them a very important lesson, which is, hey, do this now. Let's build up. Let's recover and rest so we come back stronger. Then you try again. And that's training. And if left to his own, he wouldn't not only have done that, but he would then never know that. So you did a great job, not just as a dad, but really as a coach.
Well, but the question is, what's the difference between parenting and coaching, pedagogics? What is it called?
Pedagogy.
Pedagogy.
I would say, I think they're all in some capacity interchangeable. I think it's the title that gives different authority. For instance, I'm also my daughter's coach, and it is
difficult. Sports coach.
Sports coach. You know, I'm the coach of their team as well as her dad, and I found that most of it is similar, but I think obviously there are differences as well. But I like to say that everyone, regardless of what you do, in some capacity, you are still a coach. So if you're a brother or a sister, you're a coach for your family. If you're a parent, a husband, a wife, you're also a coach. But there are responsibilities of each that are different. You know, for instance, you know, when I'm a husband, you know, I don't act the same as when I coach my team, but there are still many similarities there too. But yeah, like part of my mission is to get everybody to identify with the idea of being a coach, that, hey, you were still your son's dad, but you also got to be his coach. And it gave you a little different authority there than maybe just being dad, you know, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. And the book you're talking about sometimes, that's Coach to Coach, and it's on Saxo, the Danish online bookstore, and it retails at 180 kroners approximately, just for the listeners. And I can put up a link for when I spread it on the social media.
That would be cool. And yeah, hey, it's an easy to read story, and it's really creating a movement here in the States where maybe one of the things I'm most proud of is some of the biggest names in coaching in the U.S. got behind the book. Like, so maybe the Danes won't recognize the names, but holy cow, like the people that said, man, I love it, I want to support it. It was really overwhelming for me because some of these guys are like my heroes, you know, when I was coming up. And yeah, it's just going to be I'm very excited to get the message out and how it's affecting people. Here would be the example, and you'll like this as a scientist. When people ask me to describe it, I said, man, what is it? You know? Yeah, the book. And what I found was when I went to medical school in the US, the first thing that they taught you was the Hippocratic Oath. You know, and everybody has heard of this from the Greek Hippocrates, and it's usually paraphrased or people summarize that to mean first do no harm. You know, it's been summarized. But if you read the real translation of the Hippocratic Oath, it's much, much longer. But all of it does essentially say, hey, as a doctor, remember the first thing is don't make anyone worse. You know, don't make them worse. Don't hurt them. Make them better. And that's where everyone starts. And what I realized was when people become a coach, there is no Hippocratic Oath. It might have been that, oh, you just played sports. Oh, you played handball. Now you're the handball coach. Oh, you're a dad and we need some help. Now you're the coach. And I think there had to be a Hippocratic Oath for coaching. And this is what that book is. I think it's when people read it, they're going to understand, wow, this job is important. Wow. I can't make people worse or say something that could ruin people for the rest of their life, because with this job, there is a lot of authority and responsibility, and maybe they didn't understand it. And I think that is the gift most of the book. And here's the line I'm using, which is cool. I don't want people to be more hypocritical. I want them to be more Hippocratical, you know, and
nice pun.
Because there are so many coaches now that it'll be a coach that's overweight and does everything wrong and physically or in health, and then tells people to work out. No one's going to listen, you know, or the coach that never ran 5 feet in their life and uses distance running as punishment for his or her athletes because they didn't perform well. Like, see, that's hypocritical, not Hippocratical. And that's what I believe my book is going to help the most. Is it the be all end all? No. But I think anyone that ever calls themselves a coach has to read this book first before they read about how to do a practice or how to coach a lift technically, because first you have to come from the right mindset. So you came from the right mindset with your son. Why? It's your son, right? You can't hurt your son. But man, coaches on the field, when it's not their son, maybe they don't treat him the same way. And I think they need to. And that's what the book is about.
Is it mostly for sports coaches, or is it coaching in the Tony Robbins sense?
I would say the lowest hanging fruit is sport coaches, of course, but so many parents and teachers are reading it and getting the same from it. I wouldn't call it a Tony Robbins book at all. It's based off the lectures that I've delivered for the last 10 years around the world and the information that has most resonated with those people. So yeah, it is not. Would I say it's motivating? Of course, it has to be as a story, but it's actionable and it's real items that I found either through my own experience or dealing with the best coaches in the world, what worked best, that I think the regular coach or the layperson needs to hear. So it's really for anyone, but without a doubt, if you're a sport coach, you have to read it. You know?
When we did the previous podcast 3.5 years ago, we talked a lot about the Training for Warriors concept and implementation and how a Training for Warriors workouts work. Yeah. And it's an interesting training brand or concept in the sense that it kind of it moves from a training concept, it transcends the boundaries of training, and that is just not a training concept. It also includes these aspects don't be offended if I say Tony Robbins coaching, but that kind of life coaching stuff.
Yeah. Here's a better way to say it is it's not a training philosophy. It's a lifestyle. And what's really cool about it, and here would be the example. I come from a strong martial arts background, and in particular, judo. And I have done deep study from training in the Kodokan in Japan to reading everything that the guy, Jigoro Kano, that created judo wrote. And what was interesting is if you look at what he did, it was all done with a similar language, but judo wasn't created to defeat someone. Judo was created to better the community and the culture of the people of Japan when they needed it most. And it thrived on the development of the people, but also mutual respect and benefit of the two people performing judo together, because you can't do it alone. And I took so many of the concepts that I loved, that I saw how smart this guy was when he created it, and applied it to training for warriors, where when you do judo, judo doesn't just affect you on the mat. Judo becomes a way that you live your entire life. It changes the way you have conversations. It changes the way you interact with other people. It changes the way you eat, the way you move, the way you do things, whether either more or less efficiently in your life. And what I did was I set out from the onset that this was what training for warriors would be. Training for warriors wasn't just going to be some workout that anyone can do. It was going to be a philosophy and a mindset that people could be part of when they needed it most. And that's why I think it's very interesting in our current dilemma. I think many gyms are going to go away, but the places that have offered this lifestyle to people that they can't be without are going to continue to survive. And so I would describe it that way versus, I don't know. Yeah, Training for Warriors isn't some motivational seminar. Training for Warriors is a philosophy and a lifestyle on how you should live your life beyond the gym. And this is where we're helping people the most, because let's be honest, fitness doesn't come from the 3 hours you spend in the gym a week. Fitness comes from the 165 hours you're not in the gym a week, and how that's influenced. And the coach has a tremendous impact there too, where it's interesting. Listen to this. Somebody read the book and said, my God, we need this more than ever right now. So I'm going to read from my book right here. It says, it's not what a coach gets a person to do when they are with them, but what they do when they are not with them that demonstrates the true influence and skill of that coach. And I believe that's true of a training system as well, where now people are in their homes and the training systems that had the greatest impact on them will be the ones that continue to thrive even under this circumstance. And I know Training for Warriors is one of those. Hopefully that gives it a great explanation too. And people are hearing it from the source, because as the founder and the creator, that is, it's what I always envisioned. And now we're going to see it more true than ever.
So I have a question. One of the things that makes a training for warriors workout different than from going to another functional, whatever training concept, is this concept of the coach telling a story.
Yeah.
Like a motivational story of sorts before the workout really begins. Can you tell how that came to be?
Well, how it started originally was with all my elite athletes, so my NFL guys. The NFL Combine actually is probably the history of it, and my high school teams. But when I would perform training, say 20 years ago, with the NFL guys, they would actually come and live with me. So they would come and live at our facility for up to 6 months in preparation to try to make it to the NFL. And now imagine that you're training these people two times a day, three times a day, every day. And then I would go to the hotels and we would do pool workouts and we would handle all their nutrition. I mean, we took over their lives. And what I really realized was they needed something to connect to, but we had to have themes for the week, themes for the month. And that's where I started telling stories. And you know, what's pretty interesting is some of the biggest, like Sports Illustrated, the Sporting News, they would come to watch my training. And when I would say, what did you like the most? Did you like it? And I would say, did you see the barefoot training? Look at my plyometrics. Oh, do you see the shakes I'm making? And they all said, man, the coolest part was the way you were connecting with these athletes, the way that you got them to all sit and listen. It was like a class, you know? And that's where it all started. And then I adapted it for my fighters, and I adapted it for my high school teams and my camps. And it was part of my style. I mean, I love stories, and I love it, the motivation too. And yeah, and when Training for Warriors kind of got created, that became a big aspect of it. And I'll say this, every day I get emails from around the world from people that I don't know that are training in our programs that'll say, man, I needed to hear that today. You just saved my life, you know? And so there is an importance. And that is the reason Coach to Coach, the new book, is a story, that it's not a textbook, because people don't just want a textbook, you know, and that maybe isn't the best way we learn. If we look at the brain and how we learn either music or through story, we evolved like this with oral history, you know, before there was the written word, you know, and that's how things were passed down, and that's how our brains were able to process information. So I think we still have that. And maybe that's the power of a story, how it taps into it at Training for Warriors too.
So just for the listeners that are not aware of this, so that there's this literal, the coach is telling a motivational story at each workout. So yeah. Question for you, the stories, do you have, like, when you have the branded Training for Warriors concept, do you have to leave a list of stories you distribute for the coaches?
Every day when someone is a Training for Warriors licensee, like Dennis in Svendborg, where I recommend everybody in Denmark go check it out. His gym is, I would say, I'll be bold to say this, I think it's the best one in our entire network of hundreds of facilities around the world. What he has done in Svendborg and the facility, I don't know if you've seen it, Anders, the new one. You have to see it. Have him take you on a video tour. It's insane. And then you will see about the values, the story, like how it all comes together. So he has created a Training for Warriors Disneyland in Svendborg. And but every day he knows, he has the story, the themes, the workouts, all of it. It's all done. So he doesn't have to think. He just has to coach.
It comes scripted.
Okay. And that's been my opus. It's taken me 20 years. Remember, Training for Warriors started in 1998. So we're coming up on 22 years, you know? Yeah. So it's taken so long to collect this and perfect this. And we're always getting better too. But now with the power of our network, we have a snowball rolling, because we get great ideas from everywhere, you know, like I talked about with the Overskudd. That's an idea that everyone in our network is using and understands as one of our values because of Denmark and its power in the system too. So I believe, man, hey, there is no perfect system, but this system, when operated perfectly, has tremendous effect on people. And I only hope that, and I envision, you know, right now we have 15 in Finland. I want the same thing to happen in Denmark, and that it really helps the Danes, not just physically, but mentally too.
How does that work in Finland? The Finns are interesting people, and like getting them on the bandwagon with the stories and the enthusiasm thing.
It's funny. You're so right. Where at first I've been going to Finland for 15 years, and I've spent more time in Finland than I have in any other country, which is a pretty cool stat. And they are a different breed, but it's really changing. And I couldn't be more proud of how Training for Warriors is done. Like, my joke is every time I go back now and I go to our gyms and I see how the people are on fire and they're going crazy, I say, this can't be Finland. They're like, this isn't Finland. Like, what's happening here, you know? And at first it was difficult, but I would say this, Finland, that persona needed my system the most. And it resonated so strongly that that's how it took off like wild. And here, for as we, sometimes you could say weird as the personality is, here's the thing that's interesting. I would say to them, I'd say, man, you're doing it all perfectly. Like that's what I will be bold to say too. Dennis has the best gym, Finland runs the system the tightest of anywhere in the world. And when I would ask them, how do you do it like this? Here's what they would say. They say, Martin, we're Finns. We follow the directions. Yeah. And so I think that's their greatest strength, is when you tell them this is how something should be done, they do it. Whereas in America, when you say this is how it should be done, they all want to try something their own a little bit too.
Yeah.
And and that sometimes makes a system tough because they don't want to follow the directions. But definitely Scandinavia is a real strength. Iceland too. Like our Icelandic guys, man, they're on fire.
You know, here in Scandinavia, we'd say that the Danes are the Latinos of Scandinavia, and then the Finns have got to be something like the Germans or the Japanese. I don't know, but somewhere in between those.
Well, I would say they're the Finns. See, the Finns have their own thing. Yeah. The Japanese and the Germans are the Finns of Europe and Asia. That's how you got to say it.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. Really cool. Maybe could lead to a discussion. I did people ask me too, why does Scandinavia resonate with me so much? Why do I spend so much time there? And I did a DNA test recently, and man, I came back a big percentage Scandinavian, which was really, I guess not surprising, because obviously with the Irish last name, I'm sure that the originators of Ireland and those Celtic countries was the Scandinavians. But when people also ask me, hey, what would you prefer? We've been having some cool conversations with the kids lately as conversation starters. And they said, Dad, what would you rather have? Really cold or really hot, if you only had a choice? And I choose really cold. You know, I'd rather be really cold and dress warm than really hot and sweating my butt off. And, I don't know. There's all these things that point to the culture that I've experienced there that resonates with me, you know, from the hygge to the Scandinavian mindset, which I love, you know, and I just have so much fun there.
And the abundant drinking.
Ah, you know, that kind of stuff. You know what's funny though, too? I think Scandinavians sometimes, we say all those things, but man, I've been everywhere in the world and I don't see everybody drinking any more or any less, whether it's coffee, the alcohol. Hey, I will say smoking, we've wiped that out in a lot of places in the US and things like that. So maybe that needs to go in Scandinavia. But man, I'm not, I don't know. I think sometimes the Scandinavians are a little too hard on themselves, you know, like, oh, depression is high and this is high and that is high. Man, I don't know where we get our stats, because in the US, when we read the hygge books, it says Scandinavians are the most happy people in the world. There's this new guy, he's a Danish guy, I think, who's done this happiness research and like that's all that America hears is Denmark's the greatest place in the world. So I hope everybody listening, it's what you think, you know, whereas, hey, I believe America is great too, but then I go around the world and people say, oh, isn't America shit? Doesn't everybody hate America? No, like America's great. So I think sometimes we have this idea in our own country that isn't the same as the rest of the world sees it, you know?
Yeah. I would like to go back to the stories told at the Training for Warriors sessions. So I don't remember I don't know if you remember the last time we talked. I'm somewhat in opposition to the whole notion of positive psychology and the American, like the Tony Robbins style of coaching. And I think you were slightly surprised at me having that position back then, far as I recall, at least.
I can't remember because I was probably trying to stay too positive.
Maybe, yeah, but one thing I have to say is that storytelling is irrespective of your position towards positive psychology or not. The whole storytelling is pretty clever because it is the only, it is actually the only way to hijack the emotional apparatus of the brain. And that works if you can tell a story that pulls people in and enough that they identify with the story somehow. That is the only way to directly influence the emotions of someone. Yeah, so I don't know. Do you read comic books?
When I was a kid, for okay, sure.
There's this British guy called Alan Moore. He's the one, he actually wrote the V for Vendetta and the Watchmen comic books that has been filmed. So you should really, really, it's for comic snobs, they're called the graphic novels because it sounds better than comics.
I have Watchmen on my shelves, of course, and I'm very familiar with the guys. I guess what I would say is now where I spend so much time, I read, like I'm a reader, but now I'm much, for instance, my best trophy case is my library, you know, now when I'm reading, it's not as much that kind of stuff as much.
But my point was, if have you read the V for Vendetta comic?
That one, no, but okay. Watchmen, yeah.
But the V for Vendetta comic is probably the one piece of fiction that has pulled more people towards having an anarchistic point of view than any other.
Yeah.
Through telling a story. A compassionate.
Is that the guy with the white mask? He's the one with the.
It's a story about the development of an authoritarian state in England with inspiration like from Thatcher, and then just going full way beyond Thatcher and then like the revolt against that, and it's an amazing story, a very, very strong story.
Stories have the response. Hey, going on that line too, Ayn Rand's work, you know, from Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead, that's a story.
Yeah.
But man, it's had this incredible effect on people for a lot of years. Yeah. You know, so it's a
great example.
You know. Yeah, similar concept of how she tried to get her psychological study across, you know. But hey, but even right now, Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, it's his story, but it's a story that has really affected people so crazy too, from the concentration camps of, you know, Germany. And yeah, so the examples are always there. And I couldn't agree with you more that I think stories are how we learn. And
it's the only way to hijack people's emotions directly. And if you're good at doing the story stuff, then you get to hijack people's emotions the way you like.
And you know my style. When I speak in my seminars too, I tell stories. I don't. I don't sit there and bury them in text and research. But I guess that was always. I didn't do it completely by design. I guess I did it by feel. Like that's what I enjoy. So that was the angle that I went, you know. But without a doubt, I agree. And I'm reading a book right now. It's interesting. It's a book about the concept of streaks and how human beings we're not really good at seeing things that are random. We don't believe they're random. We think there are
patterns.
Yeah. And they're citing all these stories about Tversky and Kahneman, and but also applying it to basketball and all these other cool. So the guy is telling stories almost like a Malcolm Gladwell book. You know how he tells stories to get the points across, like Tipping Point or Blink or any of those Outliers especially. And I love that because they hijack my brain, where when I'm also reading, man, I don't want to read just some book about a topic I can't digest. And it's funny because I never wrote the book on coaching for so long because it just didn't feel right. And then I said, why don't I try a story? But it got hard because I had to completely make up a whole story. So it was fun, but it was that was the most difficult part, was to how do I teach my lessons in a story that isn't my story, you know? So that it took a long time, you know, to do it.
In medicine or physiotherapy, there's this notion of the therapeutic alliance, which is described formally in a number of like validated questionnaires that can be used, both from the perspective of the therapeut or the doctor, and from the perspective of the client or patient. And it is very well shown now that the perceived therapeutic alliance, especially from the perspective of the client or the patient, is a much more important predictor of the outcome of the than pretty much anything else.
Yeah, than even prescriptive medicine. So I did, it's very interesting. And where they came with this, I think it's Wampolsky is one of the scientists. And this was something I studied a lot because I wanted to also apply it to coaching. And they did one of the biggest longitudinal studies on medicine, education, the styles of the doctors, and psychiatrists. And what they found was the relationship or the engagement and the thought whether the patient thought that the doctor or psychologist or psychiatrist cared if the person got better almost had more effect, not saying placebo, if you will, but it had more effect than the medicine or the style of teaching or surgery. So I definitely agree, because the more I've had the right bonds with the people I coach, the better the outcome has been. And but yet I still think we all have to crack the code on how that's done, because it's, yeah, you know, there are soft skills, you know. But I would say this, my book goes so along the lines with that concept more than, hey, here's how you run a practice. Now do 10 of these. Let's do 15 of this. My book is about generating the coach's alliance with the person you're working with.
But I really think that the coach, trainer, trainee alliance, or whatever you want to call it, is an underappreciated concept, both scientifically and empirically in the trenches, so to speak.
Because of all the
coaches and trainers I know, when I ask them if they've ever had an athlete with whom they had a bad alliance, if that training worked out well, and no one says yes to that.
Yeah, it's never. It just
not going to work.
It's so funny you say that, because the guy that doesn't like positive psychology loves the idea of the therapeutic alliance, which is, I love it, because that's a, you know, you would think it's not that they're different, but it'd be easy to say, it doesn't matter, just do the right training and people will be better. But yeah, I couldn't, here's how I would say it, Anders. You'll love this story. My coach when I was young, the one that had the biggest influence on me, we had the strongest relationship and I performed at my best. I would probably say I was highest level when I was younger in comparison to the rest of the world at that age, you know?
Like teenager?
Teenager, like 16, 17, where I was performing in the javelin throw compared to then when I went to college, I had no alliance with the coach. He didn't care about me at all, never spent any time. And I didn't get any better. But here's where it gets interesting. When I then got all my degrees and learned all my science, I realized that my high school coach didn't know that much. He wasn't that knowledgeable. And I started to resent him. I started to say, man, if he could have known more, I would have been better. Man, if he could have this or that or this. And then I became a coach. And then I realized his genius was the therapeutic alliance. His genius was the way he engaged. And like, it was like he was like, you know, my dad. It was like he cared more about me than anybody and the things that he did to help me. And how I rewarded him was I won. You know, how I rewarded him was with my best. And he did have the knowledge I needed. It wasn't the deep science. We had more than enough. But why I performed at my best was that engagement. And that's what it's funny you say this, because I teach that in my seminars. I just teach it at a very layperson's level instead of explaining, the depth of those longitudinal studies and the therapeutic alliance. And what I just call it is engagement. So I just say the coach has to, the level of engagement between the coach and the athlete.
It's reciprocal, and that's important.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So, hey, I don't know about you, but I'm having a lot of fun with this conversation because you got a really good mind, man. And it's stimulating me but do you see how what I love is to be able to take a very deep concept, but explain it for everyone to understand. I think a coach has to do that, but you're bringing out some really great stuff. And that one could be the most important, because now watch, what about the alliance of the parent and the child, and the success that happens. And I think there's a direct correlation there too, that the parent could have all the knowledge in the world, but man, if they do not have the skills to create the alliance, it can be a disaster.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, and yeah, so, and hey, look at this crisis right now. My Training for Warriors that have the strongest alliance, and I'll say this, Dennis has an incredible alliance with the people in Svendborg, and that's why the business is going to continue to thrive when this is all over, where the places that didn't have that alliance, because they couldn't even fathom it, they thought it was about a workout or what push-up they know, they're going to be in big trouble, you know, for sure.
My son, he's 16, and he thinks now, at least, that he wants to do to study sports or physiotherapy and become a coach, strength and conditioning, kind of that kind of stuff. And he's been asking me how to start. And I always say to him, just start practicing humaning. That's what I tell him, actually.
Yeah.
Start practicing humaning, and talk to people.
Tell him he's got to read my book first.
Yeah. But I mean, that's, well, I think that's really important, just to start talking to people. And
oh, yeah. Well, and remember, I think he's going to have a great leader in you where you're going to set him straight. Here's how I would say it. I like to describe it as the yin and the yang, where there are two sides. Hey, dive into the technology, dive into the technique, dive into the knowledge and the science. But that's only one half.
Yeah.
And this half, the other half that we're talking about, whether you call them, sometimes they're called the soft skills, whether you call them connecting, relationships, human, like you said, you got to have both. And I think there will be, my book, I'm trying to make it that it's a movement for people to understand it's both, that I think that will happen as people become more connected, because the old coach in the United States in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, the ones that I experienced, they were just these military hard guys that punished you and you were nothing, and they're going to try to use negative reinforcement to motivate you. And those days are over, right? Like, it's a cool line I've used is, you have to coach the exact person that's in front of you right then. And the new generation, that they don't respond to that. That'll shut them down. And you need to know how to connect to them where they are. And but that doesn't mean don't learn the science. Like, as everybody could see, I love both. Like, I'm stimulated so much by understanding the science. You know, again, from, like, right now I'm reading Kahneman's book about thinking. Like, the book is just about thinking.
It's a good book.
And I have a feeling you and I are into a lot of the same ideas from the stuff we're talking about. And but I love that. But yet you've got to be able to also apply it to life, you know, and that's, you know, it's being both sides, where if you're just the science guy and you can't talk to people, you won't win. And if you're just the Tony Robbins and you have no substance, you're dead too.
Yep.
You know, so it's you know, and that's why I guess I want to be both.
Yeah. Well, you have an immense amount of experience as a coach. And on my behalf, I have probably more experience on the science part, because I used to work as a scientist. And a lot of people, a lot of people come to me and they kind of look for a hack or a shortcut in science. And it's, knowing a lot of the literature, the more you know, the more obvious it becomes that there are pretty much no hacks or no shortcuts. And it's always sad that you have to, people always get so sad when I say there's no shortcuts.
Well, and you know what's, and the sadder part is, and the people already have the information they need to know.
Yeah.
Like, man, people always ask me, what's the shortcut or the special food or supplement for diet? And I say, it's, you know, caloric deficit and eat the right foods. And you already know what they are. Like, it's not hard. They don't lack the knowledge. They lack the discipline. So then they try to find a hack. So anybody looking for a hack doesn't want to follow the discipline of the truth, you know? So,
I think there's another point to that, actually, because a lot of the contemporary fitness and health, to the total influence from media, there's a lot of the way that the industry is monetarized, by a lot of the people that are making money in this field, the way that they do it is by establishing some kind of FOMO. So they have this, they each have their pet peeve, and they inflate the importance of that pet peeve, and that leaves all the normal people with 200 pet peeves, so they become unable to discern them and say which one is important and which one isn't.
Yeah, no, for sure. And hey, so what's the lesson there, Anders? Is choose your influencer wisely. Yeah. You know, choose your guru wisely.
But actually, that's really sad. I've written a book about plant-based diets, because in these days, people, there's a great push to become more plant-based, and I'm trying to be more plant, eat less meat as well myself, and it's been a struggle because of there's some like craft to making decent food or well-tasting food, and there's some stuff about like the nutrition aspects as well, and a lot of the diehard vegans have been mad at me for like being moderate because I'm not extreme enough, but then at the same time I kind of started a couple of fights with some of the carnivore guys. Have you? And so now both of those thinks I'm stupid, but that's okay. But the interesting thing is, you know, that there's an identity political aspect to dietary patterns, so that people that are vegan, it's actually fairly well proven scientifically that people that are vegan tend to be more empathetic and compassionate about the earth and about animals, and tend to be more left-winged in all the meaningful political spectra. Whereas people that, my own observation and my own guess is that the carnivore people tend to be more right-wing and maybe even alt-right, that kind of people. But the thing is, people don't know what the biomarkers of that stuff mean. So they find someone they believe in, and then they believe, and then they just believe what he says. So now people have opinions about HDL and triglycerides and whatnot, even though they're totally unequipped to have attitudes about that, because they chose to adopt the view of some influencer. And the way that people choose influencers are not informed by science; they're informed by rapport of some sorts with. So that system, because we're living in this hyper-complex reality where it has become impossible for people to be informed on most aspects of their life, then they have to follow whatever someone says or believe someone. And the way they choose that someone is a really shitty process in general, and that's a huge problem.
And that's, we're making people aware of that. And here's what I would say too is then – also the challenge, I consider myself an influencer. I know people listen to what I say. Yeah. And because I understand the responsibility of that, I guess that's the weird part, because I guess I can't get inside the head of other influencers, but but I'm not gonna, I would never share things, I don't know, that aren't either backed empirically or that could make people worse. I don't know. Like that isn't my style, but I guess I'm trying to put myself in the head of a guy that's sharing silly information about, say, a supplement that doesn't work. I can't understand it, you know? So I guess the sadder part is the influencers themselves are maybe trying to just make a buck instead of doing their job by moving people forward and bettering them than before they met them. And I guess that's the standpoint I always come from. Is anything that I share, I'm very careful and very cognizant that it's the right message, the right time, you know, not vulgar, and but also, you know, not something charged where people are going to start going crazy one side or the other, you know. And by doing that for my whole career, it's also allowed me to, I guess, help everybody, like you said, versus taking a very polar standpoint on something and arguing about it. Cause I don't know. Like the fact that you eat meat and plant-based shouldn't lead to arguments. you know what I mean? But,
do you know Ben Greenfield?
I know the name. Yeah. I know the name. Yeah.
He's one of these biohackers and he's become kind of the biohacker, male version of Gwyneth Paltrow. So every week he has a new thing that is the most important thing to implement for mental acuity, clarity. I mean, that's stuff every week. Every week there's a new thing.
But you know what's funny is I don't even, you know what, like, because we said it earlier, I'm not looking for any hacks. You know, because here's the thing. Hack in English is a negative word. If you're a hack.
Yeah, it's not good.
Hack, like, yeah, if you're a hack, it means like you're not really good at anything and you haven't spent a very much time on that thing to ever be good. So I don't hack anything. I don't know. I do the deep work. So I have no time to listen to any of these things, you know, I get where, you know, again, like I'm spending my time listening to Kahneman. That dude's not a hack. The book's 600 pages. He's not hacking anything.
Yeah.
You know, he's giving, you know, he's giving the real stuff. So maybe that's an interesting thing is, I'm not trying to hack anything. If I want to know about diet, I need to understand it. And I've spent 20 years looking at it. So there's, you know, I'm not trying to find a 5-minute hack. If you are, you're not serious. I didn't hack judo. I spent 15 years studying it. There's no black belt. Yeah, there's no black belt hacks, man. You gotta.
But you get those questions as well, don't you?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Of course, every day. And that's because people want the easy road. They want the path of least resistance. But what that shows is they have a discipline problem and they are impatient. They have a patience problem, which is one giant piece of being disciplined. So unfortunate as it is, if just enough people understand more how you select where you get your information is very important, that would be the best thing we could do. And then maybe some of these, you know, like when somebody shows their butt on Instagram and now they're an expert, that probably isn't the best way to choose your where you get your info.
Well, no, but that's, unfortunately, that's how a lot of the world works these days, unfortunately.
Yeah, for sure.
I think it's getting 6 o'clock here and I have to get home and make some food and I'm making...
This was great and I hope... Hey, if for everybody listening or that heard this, if you loved it, write into Anders and tell him, man, you guys got to do more. You got to do something else. And we'll, you know, because I think we're just scratching the tip of the iceberg. But yeah, I have to go too. That went way longer than I thought, but that was stimulating.
Nice talk.
And I hope everybody listening got something too.
So before you go, can you just tell your listeners where on the various platforms and social media they can follow you?
Yeah. Well, hey, you can find me on Instagram at the Martin Rooney. I'm on Facebook. If people use that, just... either friend me or message me there. You can check out my website for more on Training for Warriors at trainingforwarriors.com. And definitely check out Dennis Rasmussen in Svendborg. Yeah. And, you know, he can give everybody some great information. He's such a great guy and such a great representative of our program. And hey, if people want to hear more, I do my own podcast, which gives really short half hour clips of great mindset or some of the stuff we've talked about today that can help people. That's called Into the Roar. And again, if you want to check out the book, it's Coach to Coach. And like you said, it's available. I don't know if what that's called. Saxby's, you said,
Saxo.
And you know, or wherever, you know, Amazon or other places too. But I think people will really love it. And I hope they check it out.
Yeah. Well, thank you for taking your time to talk to us and have a nice day and coaching session or whatever. No, of course you're not doing those today, but...
Well, hey, my pleasure, and make sure, tell your son 90 happens on the next session.
It will, yeah. Thank you. Nice talking to you. Bye.
Farvel.
Og det var Martin Rooney. Og det var alt for den her gang. Hans bog, Coach to Coach, den kan man altså som sagt købe ind på saxo.com. Og det var vist i virkeligheden det. Du lyttede til Fitness MK, og jeg hedder Anders Nedergaard, og du lytter med til den her og de andre episoder af Fitness MK på stream og podcast. Man kan streame den fra andersnedergaard.dk eller fra Libsyn, og man kan podcast den fra alle de store podcasttjenester, iTunes, Google Podcast, Stitcher osv. Programmet det er produceret af Jonas Pedersen, og man skal være velkommen til at skrive ind, og det kan man altså på afn@andersnedergaard.dk eller på vores Facebook-side.